From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The occupation of Iraq may be officially over, but the battle still rages for the future. Despite hefty budgets provided for American media projects there, it seems that dollars can't buy Iraqi hearts and minds, unless they're used to fix the sewage system and the electrical grid. No, it turns out only Iraqi media can win Iraqi hearts and minds. And the number one media outlet in Iraq right now is the three-month-old Radio Dijla, Iraq's first independent station. Dijla is about daily life, power outages, marital problems, sports, pop culture, freewheeling conversation, a place to complain, news you can use. What a groundbreaking concept. Ahmed Al-Rakabi is the founder and director of Radio Dijla. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you were recruited from London to help create the Iraqi Media Network, which was the coalition's effort to restart Iraqi media. And there were complaints that from the outset, it was too much under the heavy hand of Americans. Was that why you quit?
Well, simply, I couldn't do my job in the Iraqi Media Network. The money were in the hands of people who knew nothing about radio and television. We started to receive orders, and there was no way of negotiating about any program or about anything.
How did you start Radio Dijla?
Well, I came with the idea of creating a talk radio. This is the first talk radio, not only in Iraq, but I believe in the Arab world as well. It's like a member of a family here. First of all, we speak their language. We deal with their priorities. Our priorities are their priorities. For instance, the prices of the tomato paste in the street for many people are more important than the visit of the UN representative to Iraq. It has more effect on their daily life. Another reason also for the popularity is the security situation in Iraq. Since the war, they were deprived from the possibility of enjoying the nightlife. So the radio is replacing the lack of social life somehow. We're taking this night party to their home because they're not able to go outside.
So it's like a gigantic party line, but what a party it is. There are reports that your station receives roughly 18,000 calls a day.
We're creating, let's say, community feeling among the listeners. People could participate in every program. They could express their opinion freely in every program. And this is something new for them.
Your station's jingle is, "Our opinion doesn't count, it's yours which is important." What's your agenda?
What is our agenda? Remember, this country is not used to freedom of expression. And many times they were trying to press the host to express his opinion or her opinion. And therefore, we wanted to be clear that we would like to hear their opinion. It's not our opinion which matters.
Ministry officials often fix problems based on complaints they hear on your station.
Let me tell you, the situation of many ministers, because of the security situation, many ministers are deprived from having a direct contact with the street. They live in very, very heavy protected areas under heavy security. So Radio Dijla is becoming for them a very important source of understanding the opinion of the people in the street. It is a mirror of the society here. Many ministries actually are calling us, and they're telling us we would like to explain this matter. We would like to be interviewed by you if possible. Like the Ministry of Electricity is very, very much interested in Radio Dijla. They have two representatives coming almost every day to our studios, listening to the complaints, writing down the complaints. And actually, we've managed to sort out and to help many people and their problems.
You said that a lot of the officials are cut off from the people because of security concerns. But on Thursday, the Independent of London reported that your station is under 24-hour armed guard. Where does your vulnerability come from?
You never know in this place. I mean, who's your enemy and who's your friend? In ordinary people are friends of Radio Dijla. We're not afraid of the government. We haven't done anything wrong. And somehow Iraq is enjoying great freedom of expression. I mean, so far, There is no censorship.
Wait a second, though.
Things are going quite okay.
But last month, the Iraqi government announced the establishment of a media committee that would impose restrictions on print and broadcast media, and those would include, quote, unwarranted criticism of the prime minister.
Right. However, it's still not official yet. It's still under discussion, and definitely we are worried about this. We hope that we will keep the best freedom of expression in the Arab world today, which exists in Iraq now. I mean, we fought Saddam Hussein not because he had a mustache, not because his name was Saddam Hussein. I mean, we stood up against him, we fought him because of the system he created. So if we are going to create the same system again, what was the meaning of getting rid of him? If I will go back to the days of Saddam, but under different slogans, under different names, no, I'm not willing to accept this. Definitely no.
Now, some of your presenters are quite young and new to radio, but some are from Iraq's old radio guard. People like Majid Salim, who hosted a late-night show back when Saddam Hussein's son Uday controlled the airwaves.
Uday would call him and ask him, could you tell me the other half of this poem? And if he is not able to answer, they torture him. Other occasions, Uday would like to listen to a certain song. And if the song is not available, they torture him. So he spent many years like this. He's telling me now that now I feel that my life is starting. Under Uday, I always felt that every day could be the end of my life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Ahmed Al-Rakabi is director of Radio Dijla, the first independent talk radio station in Iraq.
Last week in Iraq, free press advocates were stunned when the government led by Iyad Alawi formed the Higher Media Commission. It didn't help that its newly appointed chairman, Ibrahim Janabi, was quoted in the Financial Times as saying that under new redline media restrictions, his commission would clamp down on, among other things, unwarranted criticism of the prime minister. All this occurs as the truce with radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr seems to be breaking down, putting more pressure on the new government. Simon Hayslock was the head of media development and regulation for the former Coalition Provisional Authority. He had been criticized, even on this program, for taking a heavy hand in creating the FCC-like independent media commission to regulate the Iraqi media. Now he worries that all the checks and balances he put in place to ensure press freedom may evaporate inside the old Ministry of Information, where the Higher Media Commission will make its home. Meanwhile, he says, no one knows exactly how the new commission will work.
First of all, I think we have to be clear that nobody really knows what this new commission is. I mean, I've heard it called a number of things, from a commission to a council to a committee, and all three of those have very different connotations. What I do know is that the commission, the independent commission, is still in place, and the public broadcaster is also still in place, and they haven't challenged those institutions yet.
Tell me about the man who is running the Higher Media Commission, a guy named Ibrahim Janabi, who had some rather spectacular things to say recently in the Financial Times of London.
He's very close to the Prime Minister. I think he's a senior member of the political grouping which the Prime Minister comes from. I think his primary concern is security. I think he has a background in security from his past. And as you know, that he was credited at least with saying things in the Financial Times which gave us cause for concern. But having said that, he did publicly retract and step back from many of those statements recently in a television interview on the local television station. And it was a fairly substantive piece of reassurance.
Well, in the current environment, the idea of an unrestrained and robust free press is certainly a double-edged sword. When you were in charge of media regulation at the CPA shut down a newspaper operated by al-Sadr, the firebrand cleric, who last week announced a new insurgency against the coalition. And one of the Alawi government's first acts was to actually reopen that paper. What do you make of this situation?
I think it's good that they were able to reopen that newspaper. I don't think it's a particularly widely read newspaper. But there are tensions in this environment, and I think that people need to understand that. You cannot be absolutist on this issue, either in terms of restrictions or in terms of no restrictions. It's interesting that, you know, the sorts of regulations that the FCC use and have in America are perhaps more tight on taste and decency than they are on incitement. In Iraq, it may be that there needs to be greater restrictions on content which deal with things which may incite and provoke racial hatred, violence, or civil disorder, because, you know, in the end, these are things which could destabilize the whole society.
We've just spoken to Ahmed Arakabi about the successful launch of his radio Dijla in Baghdad. It's worth noting, isn't it, that in the absence of media regulation, Radio Dijla has imposed its own sensible constraints on its broadcaster's speech, including no incitement to violence, no encouragement of ethnic hatred, no swear words, and so forth. Do you think that's evidence that an Iraqi media outlet can operate responsibly without any heavy hand of regulation?
Well, of course it is, and I'm not suggesting there should be a heavy hand of regulation. But first of all, I would disagree with you that it's developed in an unregulated atmosphere. I mean, I was responsible for issuing broadcast licenses under the CPA and spoke to Ahmed Arakabi at great length about it. Those sorts of conditions which he signed in that license were very similar to the sorts of conditions one would perhaps have seen in the FCC or in the UK through Ofcom. So, in order to encourage people like Radio Dijla, there needs to be a regulatory framework, because regulatory frameworks are not just about prescription and restriction. They're about empowerment, and that's exactly what we did with Radio Dijla and Ahmed Arakabi. And as a consequence, he's flourishing on the basis of a proper license being issued.
So we have a fledgling government and a fledgling media industry, and this new Higher Media Commission, which comes right out of the box making fairly draconian suggestions about redlining content, and then backs off. As you look at the situation as it's developed so far, what would be your prediction for where things will stand a month from now or a year from now?
Well, that's a very difficult question, because this is a very, very dangerous place to predict things. I mean, I'm reasonably hopeful that they will see that there is much more advantage for them to use the media in the way that our governments would try to do, rather than to try and control and the media in a direct and chilling way, similar or reminiscent of past regimes in the area.
Very well. Well, Simon, thank you so much.
All right.
Simon Hayslock, former head of media development and regulation for the CPA. He spoke to us by scratchy satellite phone from Baghdad.
Up next, Chinese journalism takes two steps forward, one step back. Also, the passion of Washington's self-appointed media messiah.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In China, a bold and hugely successful tabloid has been slapped down by a government angered by its exposés. The crusading editor has sat in jail since spring awaiting charges, and two of his colleagues have been hit with 6 and 8 year prison sentences for what appear to be trumped-up charges of corruption and bribery. Last year, the Southern Metropolis Daily ran a story that made journalistic history in China when it cast a bright light on old laws that allowed police abuses to go unchecked. But since no good deed goes unpunished, the paper's top staff was. Philip P. Pan wrote about it last weekend for The Washington Post. He told us that Chinese journalism has been thrown into confusion by, of all things, the profit motive.
All the newspapers in China are controlled by the Communist Party. The party decided about 10 years ago that its newspapers needed to make money. It's forcing the newspapers and other media outlets to be responsible for their own profits and losses, to withdraw subsidies from these institutions. And so, you know, when they took these steps, these newspapers and television stations, they realized that in order to make money, they needed to produce journalism that people actually wanted to read instead of boring articles about Marxism and communism.
And one of the great Cinderella stories was the Southern Metropolis Daily. Tell me about how it broke out, what kind of stories it was doing.
One of the first things it did that made a splash was the day Princess Diana died in Paris. It devoted a quarter of its pages to that story. Everybody else covered the Princess Diana story with only a few hundred words. It began publishing consumer sections, and they began becoming more aggressive about coverage of crime, of corruption, of social issues. And it was really a pioneer in local journalism. Other newspapers in China had attempted to attract readers with sort of this hard-hitting type journalism. But they always focused on stories and scandals that were occurring outside the local area. This newspaper, the Southern Metropolis Daily, took it a step further and began publishing tough stories about the community it was published in.
So let's get to the story that was published on April 25th, 2003.
What happened was a college graduate who had come to Guangzhou to work as a graphic designer had left his apartment, I think, in the evening one night, and he was basically detained, stopped on the street by police officers who asked to see his residency papers. He didn't have his temporary residence card with him, and he was taken to a detention center. And 3 or 4 days later, he was beaten to death in the detention camp. His family suspected foul play, went to these reporters, and they were able to get an autopsy done, which concluded that it was a beating.
And more remarkable than the fact that they were able to get this story into print was what happened afterwards. The government changed the laws.
It was quite amazing. Within 2 months, the government backed down and abolished these detention centers and abolished the law that allowed police to detain people almost at will, basically. And this had been a long-time goal of human rights activists. What had happened was once this story was published, newspapers around the country picked it up, republished it. It was posted on the internet, and tens of thousands of people wrote in on these websites just expressing their outrage at what happened to this college graduate. This happened just a few months after the new leadership in China took power, and at the time it was seen as an attempt by the new leadership to demonstrate that they were a new generation and that they were going to do things differently. This came at the same time as the SARS crisis in China, in which the press, after the cover-up was revealed, the press was allowed to report quite fully about the epidemic. And there was quite a bit of excitement that the new leadership was going to recognize the role of the press.
All right, this big scoop was 15 months ago. It was an optimistic moment, but now three principals of this newspaper are languishing in jail. What happened?
Based on the people I've talked to, it seems that even though there are people in the party at the senior levels who appreciated what this newspaper had done, the local officials didn't appreciate it at all. This story that they published probably ended the career of many of the local communist leaders there. And from what I understand, the local leaders were determined to find a way to punish this newspaper. Today, because there's such a division in the party itself about what the proper role of the press is, it's not easy for a local official to simply order a party newspaper to be shut down. He has to find an excuse. He has to find a reason.
And the crimes they are alleged to have committed had to do with the equivalent of expense account irregularities for very small sums of money.
Part of this is the legacy of the fact that it's not really clear, are these newspapers companies? Are these newspapers government agencies? It's not really clear what laws should apply to them. These newspapers felt that they were companies and that they had the right to distribute funds if they saw fit. The courts that have convicted them have taken a different position, that these newspapers are essentially government agencies, and they did not have approval to distribute the money that they did.
Is there any question in your mind, or in anybody's mind for that matter, that the arrests and prosecution of these men was retaliation for their journalistic exuberance as opposed to just a coincidence?
I think there's little doubt that what happened was simply retaliation. The amount of money involved in these cases is minimal compared to some of the major big corruption cases that we've seen in China. And in many of these big money corruption cases that we see, officials and other people find themselves with very short prison terms, if any prison terms at all.
Considering the new enlightenment at the national level, is there any chance that national party leaders will intervene in this case?
If I were going to put money on it, I think it's not going to happen unless there's a lot of international pressure. I think the jury is still out on whether this new leadership is truly enlightened or not. That decision that they made to abolish these detention camps and remove this law, that was a step forward. But what we've seen here is a step backward.
All right, Philip. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Philip P. Pan is the Washington Post bureau chief in Beijing.
And now an update. In May, we related the saga of Sybil Edmonds, the FBI translator turned whistleblower who brought claims of FBI failures to the attention of the 9/11 Commission, the FBI brass, and indirectly to the public. We noticed the story because the Justice Department responded to her allegations by imposing a gag order on her, retroactively classifying documents, and invoking the state's secrets privilege. And because the whistleblower was fired and thrown out of her office, though FBI officials claim that there was no connection between her allegations and her lost job. Last week, a Justice Department investigation found otherwise, concluding that Edmonds' charges, quote, were at least a contributing factor in her termination. That comes from a classified letter from FBI Director Robert S. Mueller to members of Congress. The document, leaked to the New York Times last week, also states that the Bureau is considering disciplinary action against some parties involved in the firing.
And now some corrections. Many of you wrote to point out that in our story about the French media response to a faked anti-Semitic hate crime, we failed to mention that the woman who perpetrated the hoax wasn't Jewish. S. Michaels of Los Angeles writes, "It matters to Jews to have this fact pointed out, lest people think that the woman who made up the story about anti-Semitism was Jewish." Also last week, I took full advantage of my two opportunities to mispronounce the name of one of our guests. I spoke to Mirza Baig, one of the founders of the humor website Islamica News. Keep your comments and corrections coming right to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Not that that necessarily means we'll get it right. On Wednesday, the Washington newsletter TheHill.com noted that the Reverend Sun Myung Moon has embarked on an ambitious campaign to influence lawmakers and UN ambassadors with a series of junkets and seminars. Usually, the events occur under the umbrella of one of his many organizations, with names like the Women's Federation for World Peace, the World Culture and Sports Festival, and the Middle East Peace Initiative. But most famously, roughly a dozen legislators gathered in a Senate office building this past March to honor his most durable brand name, the Washington Times. Or so they thought. Actually, they were there to crown Moon, quote, humanity's savior, messiah, returning lord, and true parent. According to the Washington Post, Moon told the group that, quote, even dictators like Stalin and Hitler have found strength in my teachings, mended their ways, and have been reborn as new persons. Reporter John Gorenfeld broke the story of Moon's Capitol Hill coronation on the websites Gadflyer.com and Salon. We wondered whether the Washington Times is merely a conservative media outlet or whether it can be fairly called the mouthpiece of Sun Myung Moon. John? Welcome to OTM.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as we talk through the history of the Washington Times, let's begin with the speech he gave at the paper's 15th anniversary dinner in Washington in June of 1997.
When the world was adrift on the stormy waves of the Cold War, I established the Washington Times to fulfill God's dispersed desire to save this world.
So Moon says that in the face of the rising threat of the Cold War, he established the Washington Times to fulfill God's desperate desire to save the world. Is this actually how Moon envisions the role of his paper?
Yes, Reverend Moon envisions his paper as having a messianic role in Washington, D.C., as something that saved the world from communism and will save the world from the evils that Reverend Moon sees in its culture. Reverend Moon says he wants to knock over the barrier between church and state, which he says is Satan's work. He wants to make the church replace the state and create a worldwide, and I'm not just making this up, religious body with him in charge. Reverend Moon sees America as suffering from what he calls free sex, from homosexuality, which he says he wants to eliminate. And Reverend Moon hopes that the Washington Times will help to move America closer to his vision. I think being the owner of a newspaper has opened up a whole new world of deference to Reverend Moon, a figure who otherwise would have been not only on the farthest fringes of Washington society, but widely considered a menacing cult leader, or at least that was his reputation in the 70s.
And conservative politicians have certainly embraced at least part of his vision. Here's Ronald Reagan at that very anniversary dinner in 1997.
The American people know the truth. And you, my friends, at the Washington Times have told it to them. It wasn't always the popular thing to do, but you were a loud and powerful voice. Like me, you arrived in Washington at the beginning of the most momentous decade of the century. Together, we rolled up our sleeves and got to work. And, oh yes, we won the Cold War.
He talks as if the paper were actually a partner in the conservative movement.
The paper and the Moon Organization really put its money where its mouth was and sent a check for $100,000 to start Oliver North's Freedom Fund, the Iran-Contra project.
He was also regarded as a counterpoint to the Washington liberal media establishment. We have a cut here from George Herbert Walker Bush.
Normally, when I think of the Washington Beltway press corps, I think of, well, not going to say it, wouldn't be prudent. But when I think of the Washington Times, I think of a publication that has brought much-needed balance to the way Washington is covered these days.
The Washington Times, as the first editor, Jim Whelan, told me, was influential just by virtue of providing a platform for columnists and television talking heads to promote the conservative voice. And, of course, this was before Fox News Channel, and it really became an important part of the Reagan Revolution.
But just because the Washington Times provided a right-wing slant on the news that was welcomed by Washington conservatives doesn't mean that it was the tool of a religious cult leader with a messianic message.
Well, since its creation, its editors have said that the paper is envied for its editorial independence. The trouble is that Reverend Moon, the owner of the paper, is consistently off-message, constantly boasting that the Washington Times has given him a direct ear to the president, that it is a paper that exists as the brain, as the nervous system in Reverend Moon's body politic of the Unification Church.
So I guess the question then remains, is he trying to fulfill his destiny through the pages of the Washington Times? What makes you think that the Moon Church meddles with the paper's content? Can you give us some examples?
As recently as last year, the Washington Times devoted some space to promoting one of Reverend Moon's ideas for what he calls the Interreligious International Peace Council, with him in charge of it. This is something that the United Nations has not actually considered adopting, and yet the Washington Times, as well as UPI Wire Service, which Reverend Moon bought in 2000, have run articles suggesting that people think it's a good idea. The paper has also printed advertisements from Reverend Moon proclaiming that figures like Stalin and Hitler have endorsed Reverend Moon.
He claims to have reformed Hitler and Stalin from beyond the grave. But that was, after all, an ad. What's your evidence that his influence is growing over the news pages at the Washington Times?
The incident in 1987 when four editors of the Washington Times left claiming that the Unification Church was dictating editorial policy, that was one example of some of the things that have led people to continually question whether the Times really has the editorial independence that they very fiercely will defend.
How did all of those politicians end up at that coronation, given the kind of, let's face it, what most of us would regard as lunacy coming out of the church?
In many cases, conservatives who came to honor the Washington Times were surprised to find out that they were really coming to this coronation ceremony for Reverend Moon.
Do you think they genuinely were surprised? I know that you asked former Washington Times editor James Whelan about it. Let's hear what he had to say.
Humbug. I mean, anyone who has bothered to look at events sponsored by the Moonies, including those involving the Washington Times for the past 20 years or so, knows perfectly well that Moon presides.
Ouch. Is that fair?
I think it's pretty fair. I think that for at least 20 years, Reverend Moon has been hosting these increasingly cheeky events where he's able to get all sorts of media professionals on stage and then to announce that, yeah, that he's the Messiah. I think one sign that they may not have wandered in there by accident is that on February 4th, there was actually a kind of rehearsal for the event at the Reagan Building involving a number of congressmen as well as a crowning ceremony. While Reverend Moon was anointed as an absentee Messiah, certainly this should have gotten tongues wagging all over Washington. You would think someone somewhere in Congress would have said, You know what? Something really strange just happened at the Reagan building.
So as you lay it out, the Washington Times grew in power through the 80s and into the 90s. But where does it stand in the third millennium?
I think right now there are many other alternatives that there weren't before for finding a conservative answer to what's perceived as the liberal media. But beyond that, I think that the relationship between some of the hardline conservatives at the Washington Times and the Unification Church is starting to fray as they start to find less and less common ground. After all, Reverend Moon preaches that individualism is what God hates most, unquote, certainly not a very Republican view of the world. And it also seems to be weakening financially with the sudden collapse of some of the Washington Times' sister publications this summer, one of them being Insight magazine, another is the World and I. Both of them had their plugs pulled.
Now, John, it's fair to say that you're not entirely neutral on this issue. You clearly think that Moon is a pretty bad guy, and you've been hell-bent on exposing him. Do you think that in any way influences your evaluation of the Washington Times?
I don't think Reverend Moon is bad so much as fascinating, and whether all of this stuff should be taken literally, I'm still not quite so sure, but I am really just an amazed observer of this whole thing.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Gorenfeld is a freelance reporter based in San Francisco, California.
Coming up, what's wrong with new hospital privacy laws and medical news you probably can't use.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this year at a convention in Las Vegas, an attorney for the Radio and Television News Directors Association gave a speech entitled, "Doctor, I have an awful pain in my HIPAA." HIPAA, as any medical reporter will grouse, stands for Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. A small part of that law, known as the privacy rule, went into effect in the spring of last year and quickly became a thorn in the side of reporters like Andrew Holtz. He's a freelance medical reporter based in Portland, Oregon, and past president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists. Andrew, welcome to On the Media.
Nice to talk to you, Brooke.
So the Department of Health and Human Services drafted the privacy rule at the request of Congress, and the stated intention was to, quote, provide patients with access to their medical records and more control over how their personal health information is used and disclosed. Well, that sounds good to me. What went wrong?
I think that what I get a smell of is institutions working more to protect their own interests than really to look out just for the interests of their patients. For instance, a reporter in the Midwest reported that it was her usual practice when talking to patients on medical stories to sit down with the patient or the family, say, in the hospital cafeteria. Suddenly, with HIPAA being used as an excuse or a rationale, she was told that a minder from the hospital would have to be there. So the hospital was restricting access specifically to journalists, even to areas open to the general public.
So you don't object to the principles implied in the privacy rule. You just think that it's being applied in a way that's, frankly, directed at journalists.
There are key areas where even the obvious language of the regulation does shift the balance between the public interest and the interests of private individuals. And I think it's perhaps been shifted a little too far. For instance, in emergency medicine, I've covered stories for television on how heart attacks are treated. Well, you can't schedule a heart attack. In order to do the story, you have to be there at the moment when the patient comes in. So the general practice over the years has been you go ahead and shoot the footage, but don't use it until the patient comes around or the family agrees at their leisure that, yes, it's okay. And if they say no, the tape is destroyed. These days, that kind of thing has basically shut down.
Just for the record, and at the risk of stating what may seem obvious, why do you think it's so important that reporters have access to this kind of information?
the more you clamp down on and make it harder for journalists to talk to patients, then the less likely it is that alarm bells will go off. Often these days, you can't even find out the names of individuals or the kinds of cases that are happening in a community. So reporters need to press as hard as they can and document these cases where the restriction of information has ended up harming the community or harming patients because they didn't realize perhaps that a bad outcome they had was part of a larger pattern of bad outcomes in that institution.
Well, there has been a longstanding tug of war between privacy and the public's right to know, and usually this gets played out in the courts. Is that where you see this issue heading?
Yes, and actually, I'm a little bit surprised it hasn't gotten there faster. Eventually, the courts will have to decide what exactly the regulations do say, because there are quite a few areas that are left open to interpretation.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Andrew Holtz is a member of the board of the Association of Healthcare Journalists and current medical reporter based in Portland, Oregon. Last month, a panel convened by the National Institutes of Health recommended new levels for cholesterol so low that many more Americans would have to take expensive drugs to meet them. Then we learned that most of the members of that panel had ties to drug companies that made those expensive drugs. That was merely the latest example of conflict of interest in medical research that has put watchdog groups and some lawmakers on edge. Huge institutions and top-flight universities often are tainted by the corporate money that funds their research, but that's okay, because we have medical journals, those peer-reviewed paragons of probity, to sniff out the real breakthroughs buried in all those steaming piles of hype. Our doctors rely on those journals, and we rely on our doctors. But according to the research institute we call Bob Garfield, probably we trust too much.
No, you certainly can't blame Congressman Peter Deutsch for diagnosing the NIH with the, quote, disease of greed. And you can't but be appalled when universities, our cathedrals of higher learning, ride on the same gravy train. And when you sit in the internist's office waiting for the doctor to appear and you scan the array of Lipitor notepads and Viagra ballpoint pens, you can scarcely help wondering about what exactly it takes to influence what drugs get prescribed. But while you're scanning, you might also take a long, hard look at those neat stacks of handsomely bound medical journals, because within them are research studies, review articles, and editorials whose findings are as susceptible to the greed disease as any other part of the system.
I sometimes find myself worrying that a lot of medical journals have become almost a marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industry.
Richard Smith is the editor-in-chief of the venerable British Medical Journal.
For the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, and JAMA, about 70% of the randomized trials they publish are funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Now, that gets to be increasingly bothersome when you realize how good the pharmaceutical industry is at getting the results they want.
Consider, to begin with, the journal's standard practice of permitting scientific authors with financial ties to manufacturers to publish on the very drugs those manufacturers produce, the rationale being that otherwise the journals would have no access to the most distinguished researchers in their fields. Dr. Jeffrey Drazen is the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine.
If we're going to have new pharmaceuticals, they're developed by commercial entities. There needs to be an interface between the people who evaluate those drugs and people who make the drugs. If we didn't have such an interface, we'd still be using leeches.
Yes, it is axiomatic that science's greatest advancements are fueled, one way or another, by self-interest. And obviously, somebody must review and chronicle the results. The problem arises when those processes are influenced by another familiar axiom: he who pays the piper calls the tune. Shannon Brownlee, journalist and fellow with the New America Foundation, has painstakingly documented industry efforts to put drugs in the best possible light. And these, she says, are message management techniques that even the most gimlet-eyed peer reviewer is often incapable of detecting.
Peer review can only do so much. And one of the things that peer review cannot do is it cannot know which part of the data you're not even presenting. It cannot know what negative findings aren't even being submitted to the journal. And that's one of the big problems here. We don't really know how much negative data are out there.
There is a growing clamor for all clinical trials to be registered, irrespective of results, as more evidence surfaces that pharma companies routinely quash results that don't come out just right. Dr. Jane Garland heads the Mood and Anxiety Disorders Clinic at Children's and Women's Hospital in Vancouver, British Columbia. In 2001, GlaxoSmithKline enrolled some of her patients in a study on the use of the antidepressant Paxil on children. As part of the standard legal paperwork with the manufacturer, Garland agreed to keep all records pertaining to the study, including summaries of previous trials, strictly confidential for 10 years.
That was fine until I read the Paxil literature that they gave me, which included the results, or just a summary of the results, of two previous negative trials in depression. And my jaw dropped. Oh my goodness, why didn't I know this? Why wasn't this information available to me? And I began to wonder, who else knows this?
Garland decided to go public in a paper that cited the incidence of unpublished trials and warned fellow researchers not to be tricked or co-opted by enforced silence. She showed a draft to an American colleague.
He said the paper was well written, the results were cogent, but not to write anything about it because I would do a tremendous disservice to children because we know these medications work. And I'm sort of scratching my head saying, well, how do we know the medications work when the data's piling up on the side of not very much evidence that they work? And in fact, when all the data came out, 12 out of 15 antidepressant studies were negative in kids.
The most alarming of the previously suppressed news, a correlation between adolescent use of antidepressants and suicide. Far from warning the public, GlaxoSmithKline simply enrolled new groups of test subjects on the chance that the results would improve.
So to use an example, if you roll a die, you know, there's a chance it could come up anything from 1 to 6. What if you roll the dice, and every time you get something other than a 6, you don't write it down? And that's essentially what's happened.
In June, a few days after the state of New York sued over this issue, GlaxoSmithKline issued a press release calling its disclosure policy accepted standard practice for making data available. 1 week later, though, the company announced a forthcoming website that will summarize results of all of its clinical trials. It's naturally frustrating for companies who spend billions to develop drugs only to have the dice throw of medical research return not big fat sixes, but lots of twos and threes. That's when it's especially helpful to have in your employ authors paid to be not overly preoccupied with the twos and threes. Last year, London Observer reporter Anthony Barnett looked into an article in the Journal of Alimentary Pharmacology about the side effects of ulcer treatments.
There are a number of top-notch academics listed at the top of the paper, but we found out the paper was actually written by a medical writer working for AstraZeneca, which is a large British drug company that was promoting one of the drugs in the study. And lo and behold, it came out to find out that the side effects listed for that particular drug were less than had previously been reviewed.
The practice is called medical ghostwriting, which sometimes is a benign aid to brilliant scientists whose brilliance doesn't extend to their prose, and sometimes, according to Shannon Brownlee, an elaborate apparatus for laundering results.
What happens is a pharmaceutical company will fund a study which may be done in-house, may be done by doctors in community practice, which may be done by academic clinicians or some combination. So the companies go out and they hire this PhD, and the PhD writes up the paper with just the right interpretation of the data. And then the medical communications company goes and finds what's known in the business as a KOL. And the KOL is a key opinion leader, an academic clinician who's a big noise in their field. And they approach this person and they say, we have this paper. We know you're a terribly busy person. And would you like to author this paper, which we happen to have already written?
Though that authorship is not likely to be apparent to anybody. Anthony Barnett interviewed a ghostwriting agency researcher named Susanna Rees, who told him her job was to handle floppy disks going in the mail to journal editors and to electronically cover the trail.
And one of her particular jobs was to go through the computer history on the disk to ensure that there was no way of telling that the original research had come from a drug company or that the original author was a ghostwriter.
The New England Journal's Jeffrey Drazen himself encountered this process when he emailed a listed author on a bit of research data and got a return call, not from the author, but from a drug company employee.
He called me up and got on the phone, and he said, "What exactly do you want to know?" And I thought about it for a while, and I said, "I think I know everything I need to know."
Drazen insists safeguards are in place, at least at his publication, to ensure that listed authors are genuine authors and that pertinent conflicts are disclosed. But what is never disclosed is a more insidious motivation still: the journal's own dependence on drug company revenue. A February story in the Washington Post documented a case at the Journal of Dialysis and Transplantation in which the publication's marketing department vetoed an article unfavorable to one of its key advertisers, the biotech firm Amgen. And there's more. In addition to advertising, medical publishers reap enormous revenues from drug marketers for reprint rights to journal articles. Positive ones only, of course. The British Medical Journal's Richard Smith.
You might well have $1 million worth of reprints, and the profit margin on those is rather substantial. If you don't publish it, then you lose perhaps $800,000. I mean, what could be a more stark conflict of interest?
So, you're sitting in a chilly little room, your legs dangling over the examining table, your symptoms reported, and your copay paid. And your doctor takes out her prescription pad and orders Synthroid or Paxil or the ulcer drug Omeprazole. And if you're bold enough to ask why Omeprazole, and should she show you what the drug company's sales rep gave her, say a glossy reprint from the Journal of Alimentary Pharmacology, what in the world are you supposed to make of that? The answer is, you don't know. And most likely, neither does she.
If that catalog of conflict isn't depressing enough, there's a whole side of the story that didn't quite fit in. That concerns the off-label uses of drugs. That is, drugs prescribed for uses not approved by the FDA. For example, taking aspirin to reduce heart attacks was for some years an off-label use. Companies may not advertise their drugs for uses not approved by the FDA. But of course, many drugs are widely prescribed off-label, and the revenue from those sales amounts to billions. So, Bob, this may be tangential to your story, but it's big money, right?
Yeah, very big money, and not entirely tangential, by the way, because the media, including medical journals, are at the very heart of the situation.
Okay, I've performed my function here. Why don't you just go ahead?
Okay. Look, drug companies can't advertise off-label uses, so they have to generate word of mouth and publicity, which they do by funding trials and getting the results in journals, and also by cultivating key opinion leaders who hit the hustings at medical symposia to spread the word. For instance, at a recent meeting in Montreal, a key opinion leader paid by Pfizer talked up his study on the effect of the cholesterol drug Lipitor on Alzheimer's patients. Not only did he communicate this to the hundreds of gerontologists at the meeting, he got breathless media coverage about the exciting news.
Well, Bob, allow me to play devil's advocate here. If a cholesterol drug slows the advance of Alzheimer's, that is exciting news, right?
Yeah, if it's true, but who knows if it's true?
He did a study.
He did, and this particular study involved a grand total of 63 subjects. And you also can't ignore the fact that most key opinion leaders are paid one way or another by drug companies. And you just never know how that money affects the needle of anyone's moral compass. Let's take David Pekar, Dr. David Pekar. He's the former chief of experimental therapeutics at the National Institute of Mental Health and one of the world's preeminent researchers on antipsychotic drugs. He told me that he made so much money as an opinion leader, he could have done it full time, but he gave it up.
I don't miss being an opinion leader because as time and as markets became more competitive, particularly in my therapeutic area, it became more challenging to keep that internal compass going.
As it happens, Pekar is no longer at NIH. He's founder of his own company, Gabriel Pharma, in the midst of clinical trials on a schizophrenia drug that he developed.
And so now is he in the market to buy some key opinion leader buzz for his new drug?
Well, that's exactly the question I asked him, and I have to tell you, I was quite chilled by the answer he gave me.
I certainly have been approached by opinion leaders asking if I have sufficient funds for their hire.
Yeah.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Janine Price, who after 4 hard years of service is taking an extended break to see the outside world. We'll miss you.
We will. OTM is edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Vuolo. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.